So I want to begin with a story from the Zen tradition, which is a favorite story of mine. It starts with a young man who's sort of lost in his life. And he's more than lost, actually. He's feeling like he's wasted his time. He's wasted opportunities. He's made nothing of his life. Probably he's more than just wasted it. He's hurt people. And he's feeling sort of dejected, depressed, thoroughly sort of disgusted with himself. He's sort of decided, and this is sort of medieval Japan, that there isn't anything more for him in this worldly life. The only thing that he can think of doing is to enter a monastery, become a Zen monk or a disciple of a Zen monk, and dedicate his life to at least doing some good, or perhaps at least not doing some harm. So he wants to enter the monastery. And in medieval Japan, the tradition was that you don't easily enter a Zen monastery. You can try, but it's not like you just book on the internet and then turn up. You have to sort of walk to this place, and it's always snowing, apparently. So it's snowing, and traditionally you have to kneel in the snow. You have to kneel in the snow for days. It's a bit like sort of waiting at Paddington for that non-existent train. But then there's nobody going to pick you up at the station in Colwall. You just wait. Because they want to test that you're really serious before they let you in. They really want to test that you're serious. Actually, the monastery doesn't have time or resources to let anybody in. Anybody who just wants an easy life and wants to be fed and kept warm. They don't have time and resources for that. You have to be really, really serious. And to show your seriousness, you have to wait. Eventually, of course, the door opens and he's let in and has an interview with the abbot, who, you know, is in the deciding position of can he come or is he gone? And the abbot sort of talks to him a little bit and says, well, you know, what have you done with your life? And the guy says, I've done nothing. Actually, I've just drunk, I've gambled, I've hoarded, I've wasted everything that I've been given, and I've been unkind, etc., etc. You can sort of fill in the blanks. He's done nothing. And the abbot says, well, what use are you? And he says, I don't think I can do anything. I'm useless. I've got nothing that I'm good at that I can offer you. Please take me. And the abbot sort of says, well, is there anything you're good at? There must be something that you're good at. And, you know, you can tell that the abbot's sort of really just sort of stern, but also he wants to know, what is this man serious or not? And the man says, the young man says, yeah, actually, I can play chess. I'm not bad at chess. So the abbot says, okay, well, let's test that. Let's see. And he orders one of his monks' attendants to bring a chessboard and some chess pieces. And so there's this chessboard, and then he summons another monk to the table, to the room, and it's this elderly, frail man who's lived his life serving in the monastery, and, you know, he's now in the last years of his life. He's frail, he's bent over, and he's summoned to be the chess partner. And so the two of them sit down, and then the abbot produces this other surprise. He draws a sword, a sort of samurai sword, and he puts the sword beside him and says to the young man, so play. Let's see you play chess. And whoever loses will lose their head. will lose their heads. So let's see if you can really play. Yeah. And that's more than the young man sort of bargained for. He was prepared to kneel in the snow for a bit. Didn't expect his life to be on the line. And the old man doesn't sort of register anything. So the two of them start to play chess, and the young man is tense, as you can imagine, because the medieval Japanese tradition, not quite like the politically correct 21st century, the abbots in earnest, you could legitimately, as it were, in that time, in that place, chop off somebody's head. And, you know, as chairman of the Buddhist Center, one might be tempted sometimes. But unfortunately, well, we live in different times, don't we? And so the abbot is in earnest, and the young man is, there's sort of beads of sweat starting to form and trickle down the back of his neck as he starts to play. And he's got to be really focused. And this old man turns out to be not just daft, but quite a skilled chess player. More than a match for this young guy. So they start playing, and you can imagine these moves and the tension building. And what this young man does is he sort of finds a way through his fear and manages to really focus on the game. Really sort of focus in a way that he's not used to doing in his life. He focuses and starts playing the best that he's ever played. Suddenly this board, this game, is all that his world is. He can plan all his moves ahead. Suddenly there's clarity in his mind. And after a while, he gains the advantage. There's this clear sort of opening where, yes, he's moved, you know, his knight to the right place. There's an advantage. He can see. And of course, he has to keep a sort of poker face to keep that under control, to not give away his strategy, but he's got the advantage and he knows it, and he starts to sort of relax a little bit and look up and see this monk, this old wizened monk, looking back at him. And then something very strange happens, unusual, unexpected happens. He looks at this old man in front of him, and this old man seems completely at ease, completely uncomplaining, quite willing to just do whatever the abbot has requested, to the point of surrendering his own life. There's no trace of anxiety in this old monk, who must know that, oh yes, he's losing. He's losing and could lose his head. And the young man looks at him and thinks, what have I done with my life? I've done nothing. And this man has dedicated all of his life to the Dharma. He's done everything for the Dharma, tried to follow the teaching of the Buddha, tried to gain enlightenment, and now he's going to die. And what arises is, well, empathy. Empathy for this man. Compassion for this old man who's willing to surrender his life, sacrifice his life for him. And almost despite himself, he starts to deliberately make mistakes in the game. Almost despite himself, he finds that he can't win. He can't, even though he could win, there's just too much at stake to see him be responsible for the loss of this life. He can't do it. And he deliberately starts to make silly moves. And sure enough, the advantage that he had in the game you know, is quickly overturned, and he's starting to lose. And this time, there isn't the sort of dread and fear. He's deliberately surrendering. He's giving up. And the abbot sees what's happening. He knows what's happening. And suddenly, just at the point where the young man is about to, you know, be checkmated, the abbot throws the board in the air and says, "No one wins, no one loses." And then he looks at the young man and says, "Today you have learnt two lessons. You have learnt concentration and you have learnt compassion. Since you have learnt compassion, you'll do." And of course he's in. So that story, every time I hear it or read it or even tell it, it moves me. It moves me because, human kindness moves us. If we let it, that's what moves us. In a way, that's what is of value in the world. And yes, this talk is about wisdom, but it's so easy to think that wisdom is some sort of cerebral, cognitive, clever affair. That wisdom is about being clever enough to win at the game of life, the game of chess, and come out trumps. And actually it's not. Wisdom, the Buddha's wisdom, is more akin to that young man's first glimpse of kindness. That is what wisdom looks like in practice when it's embodied in a human being. That's what it starts to look like. So everything I say about the nature of the Buddha's enlightened experience, in a way we need to keep referring it back to kindness. For me, what keeps reverberating in my mind, in a way throughout my Dharma life, is my father's dying words. He died when he was still a young man. Well, he was 45, so relatively young, and I was 11, and he died quite suddenly of a heart attack. And I remember some of his dying words, and like Maitra Bandhu was saying yesterday, dying words are important, aren't they? And the dying words of the Buddha are probably verbatim what he actually said, because people remember them. Well, similarly, the dying words of your father are important. And he, while he was in agony, in painful agony, he knew he was dying, although I didn't. And what he started to say was, "I have not loved enough. I have been unkind. I have not been kind enough. I've hurt people." That's what he was saying through clenched, kind of agonizing spasms of pain. That's what he was saying. Those words have stayed with me. Those words have stayed with me. After his death, as a young boy, I started questioning what life was about. I felt his presence. I can't prove this to anybody, but I knew that that death wasn't the end, that something of his presence, of his mind, of his consciousness was still around, not in a way that I could explain, but I felt in communication with it. And various, what we would call, I guess, supernatural events, although they're not really supernatural, happened to sort of indicate that he was around and making his presence known to me and, well, to my family. All of which, none of that frightened me or spooked me out, but all of it reinforced this question that was forming, a sort of inarticulate question that was forming, and the question was something like, what is life for? So you had well, for me, a catastrophic incident in my life. You had his dying words about kindness. And then you have, for me, I had evidence that death wasn't the end, which made it even more urgent to find out what life was for. If death isn't the end, then I realized that I didn't understand what life was, because I didn't have the whole picture. I didn't know what death was. All I knew was it wasn't what I had commonly been told. Something else was going on. But that meant that something else was going on now, when we were alive. I couldn't articulate that, but that was what I felt very, very strongly. And in a way, that's what I'm still driven by. What is life for in the face of death, knowing that death isn't the end, but not really knowing what it is? Yeah? So what are we going to do now? What am I going to do now? And these dying words of kindness. So when I first came across the Dharma, though, I wasn't that interested in kindness, I must confess. I kind of wanted to know about the nature of reality. I'd studied physics. I had all sorts of ideas. And I wanted some wise teacher to take me, to recognize me as special. to then take me under their wing and give me some esoteric practices and teachings which only I would be able to practice, and then there'd be this sort of secret signal between us. I can remember Bhante Sangharakshita used to, just as I was coming along, he was living at the LBC. He soon moved after I came coming along. I can remember him sort of going for a walk and me secretly following behind, sort of at some distance, a respectable distance, thinking he's going to turn around and recognize me. And of course he didn't. But anyway, I came along to the Buddhist Center and thinking that, you know, I was going to be initiated. And the first course that I attended was a course on the precepts, on ethics, on kindness, on metta. And I just thought, oh, that's not it at all. Sort of like anybody can be kind. What about being wise? You know, what about having sort of superpowers? Anybody can be, you know, offer a packet of biscuits to a stranger. Not that I ever did, but that was the sort of level at which I was thinking, unfortunately. And in a sense, there's a little bit of truth to it, because kindness alone isn't enough. There is a lot of people who are kind in the world, who are probably much, much kinder than I am. Well, I'm definitely much, much kinder than I am. But kindness alone can be not enough. Good though it is, it's a virtue that's, in a way, I hesitate to even say it's not enough, because in a way it should be the highest virtue. So I'm slightly contradicting myself. But in a certain sense, kindness can be blind. And if it's blind, if it's not based in awareness, then it's not enough. It's not enough to answer the question of death, yeah, and what life is in the face of mortality. At least it doesn't feel that that's enough to me. And the Buddhist tradition emphasizes a direct seeing into the true nature of things. It says that that is what the goal is about, a direct penetration into the nature of reality. By direct, I mean experiential. It's not some sort of book knowledge. It's not sort of conceptual. It's a direct, felt, tasted seeing into the nature of reality. And that is, well, it's insight. It's that that is seen as the goal. So I can't talk about enlightenment, partly because I'm not enlightened, and partly because the goal of that direct seeing transcends all conceptual categories. It transcends every category that we can conceive of. And because it transcends categories, all conceptual categories, words don't do it. Yeah? You have to experience it. All the Buddha can do is point and say, look, it's like this. And then we have to do the looking, the work. And unfortunately, the reason that we don't all see it, the reason that I don't live in this insightful way all the time, is because my mind isn't fit enough to do that. Yeah, our minds are not pure enough. We're drunk. And because of that drunkenness, we don't perceive things as they are. So all of our work is to do with that sobriety, sobering up, purifying our vision, so that we can see things as they are. When we see them as they are, there'll be this aha kind of moment, and no words will be adequate. But what I do want to talk about is some of the obstacles. So Maitreya Bandhu yesterday talked very, very beautifully and very engagingly about these two ravines of views that take us downwards. This eternalist view that most religions espouse, and then this nihilist view of our modern secular consumerist world. Both of those are obstacles to this purification of heart that will be needed if we're going to see things as they are. So I just want to talk a little bit more, in a little bit more detail, about some of those obstacles, some of those views that prevent us. And I want to talk about four of them. The first one that I want to talk about is our narrowness of vision, our narrowness of perspective. Most of the time, most of us have a very narrow, self-centered perspective on the world, where each of us is the center of the universe, the complete center of the universe, and everything that happens in the entire cosmos is only relevant to the extent that it affects me. Yeah? And hopefully it will make me happy. And that's the extent of our kind of perspective most of the time. Yeah? Most of the time. And it's sort of understandable, because we're embodied creatures that need fulfillment and pleasure and happiness. So it's understandable, but it really isn't very grown up. It is the sort of perspective that Maitreya Bandhu's niece Alex, as an 8-year-old, would have. We haven't changed that. We haven't changed. I'm reminded when we think into, well, for me, images help broaden my perspective. And one image that really helps is that photograph of the Earth from outer space, called the Pale Blue Dot, taken by Voyager 1. Voyager 1 was this space probe sent into the solar system to, you know, explore Saturn, etc., etc. And off it went. And when it was sort of at the edge of the solar system, and that's something like 6 billion kilometers, Carl Sagan, he was a sort of a visionary cosmologist. He had this idea. He suggested to NASA that they could still just about communicate with Voyager, and that they instruct it to turn its camera around and take a look at Earth one last time. So that's what it did. From 6 billion kilometers away, it turned around, looked at Earth, and took a snapshot. And of course, Earth was this tiny, tiny dot that was colored blue. And this is what Carl Sagan had to say. He said, "National boundaries are not evident when we view the Earth from space. Fanatical ethnic or religious or national chauvinisms are a little difficult to maintain when we see our planet as a fragile blue crescent fading to become an inconspicuous point of light against the bastion and citadel of the stars. Travel is broadening." It's wonderful, wonderful understatement at the end. Travel is broadening. But most of the time, most of us don't have that vast perspective. Yeah, it's much more like There's no honey for my porridge this morning. That's a sort of, oh dear. What a shame. And just, well, Bhante says something. He says, Bhante, one of his quotes that I'm taking from a seminar is, he says, most of us are occupied much of the time with matters that are simply unworthy of the attention of a moderately aware human being. And how true that is. It's shaming, isn't it? Next time we come out of silence, just catch yourself. It'll probably be around dinner. Yeah? Look at where your attention goes. Or even in the silence, look at where your attention goes. On this retreat, which you've all willingly come for, some of the most profoundest truths that human beings are capable of are being laid at your feet. Yeah? Look at where your mind goes in the silence. I really like something that Einstein said. He said something very similar to Bhante. Well, he's a bit more rude. He said, I have never belonged wholeheartedly to a country, a state, nor to a circle of friends, nor even to my own family. When I was still a rather precocious young man, I already realized most vividly the futility of the hopes and aspirations that most men practice throughout their lives. And he means women as well. Well-being and happiness never appeared to me as an absolute aim. I am even inclined to compare such moral aims to the ambitions of a pig. That's interesting, isn't it? Well-being and happiness have never seemed to him an absolute aim. They're the aims that we might share with any animal, yeah? With any animal. Now, they're not, I wouldn't dismiss them in that complete sense. Fair enough, we all want well-being and happiness. But as a whole aim of life, as a direction, as a fulfillment of all our energies, of our humanity, it really is unworthy of us. Really is. For me, this is where I sometimes worry about Buddhism in the modern West. I worry that it will be reduced to a therapeutic tool for our well-being and happiness so that we can all become better consumers. Yeah? And all go shopping with a clear conscience. That would be a tragedy on the scale of human tragedies such as, you know, anything has been. We really have something incredibly precious, and we will squander it if we just think of it as for our own fulfillment in that narrow, rather silly, trivial way. Triviality is going to be the death of the Dharma in the West if we don't watch it. So yes, a narrow perspective. A narrow perspective is one of the obstacles to seeing things as they really are. A perspective that just has me at the centre of the universe. Yeah. We need a revolution in consciousness comparable to the Copernican revolution. Copernicus, his revolution before him, it was the Earth that was the centre of the cosmos. He posited that the sun was actually the centre of our solar system, of the known cosmos, and the Earth was revolving around it. Of course, the Church resisted that. It resisted such statements because it threatened the Holy See's notion of human beings as being created. We need a similar, but it was true, and it's undeniably still true. We need that sort of revolution in our consciousness where we stop seeing ourselves as the center of the universe and start seeing things a little more as they really are. Yeah? One way of doing that is just to take in other people and the reality of other people. Yeah? Simple. It's not that you have to be a cosmologist. You just have to be kind and empathize with a fellow human being who also sees themselves as the center of the universe, and you can't both be right. So empathize, and that lifts our perspective, even just a little bit. Yeah? It lifts our perspective in the direction of wisdom. Okay, I want to move on to the second obstacle. The second obstacle that I want to talk about is an assumption, a deep-seated assumption in our secular modern society, that we live in a dead universe. That we live in a universe where matter is all there is, and that matter is somehow dead, inert, lifeless. And that we are just biological machines, and this experience that we have of being conscious is just some sort of byproduct of a very, very complex brain chemistry. Yeah? That consciousness is just something that the neurons are doing because they're very complexly arranged. But basically, we're biological machines. And when we die, the lights go out and we just revert to our inert, dead state. And that everything around us is like that. Now, we might not consciously articulate our view like that, but nevertheless, it's the deep-seated assumption, it's the nihilistic assumption behind most of our Western cultural attitudes. It's the prevailing cultural assumption behind science. Not that science shows that we're dead. It's just that scientists often have this scientific materialist view as a dogma, an unquestioned dogma, behind their work. Yeah, and then we have taken it on board. And in a dead universe, you can exploit the natural world. You can exploit potentially other people, because after all, they're just biological machines. And you can basically gratify your senses to the fullest because that's all there is to do, because you're going to die. And you might as well just be comfortable until that point. And what happens is that in that dead universe, well, Bhante says enlightenment isn't possible. Yeah, enlightenment isn't possible. It's a fundamental obstacle to our thinking. The truth from the Buddha teaches is that nothing is dead. Nothing is inert. Matter, even this stuff, even the cushions that you're sitting on, they're not dead stuff. Everything is vibrating with life. It's energy, and energy is inseparable from what we call life. It is the stuff of life, and everything has that. Everything has that. Now, if you don't believe me, of course you can. I can't prove this, so you can sort of disbelieve me. But what I would urge you to do is not be an unthinking scientific materialist. At least, what you could do is look at what modern physics has to say, which is the best theory of science that we've got about matter. Look at what modern physics has to say about matter, yeah? And if you can really look at what modern physics, quantum physics, has to say about matter and not come away with your head spinning, then in a way you haven't understood. Bohr said that anybody who can encounter quantum physics and not be completely confused and perplexed hasn't understood. So I'm much more tolerant of people who understand, or at least have tried to understand, what modern science says about matter, and then say, okay, we're just matter. Matter is all there is. Because if you say that, well, the modern scientific perspective on matter is that we don't have a clue. We don't have a clue what any little elementary particle is. What's really weird is when these elementary particles seem to change their behavior depending on whether they're being observed or not. That's really weird. Yeah? When an electron can start changing its behavior because it knows that it's being observed, that confounds your notion of matter. Yeah? Unfortunately, most physicists don't think about such things. I was recently fortunate enough to go to CERN. A friend of mine was invited on a TED conference to CERN, and he invited me, and off we went, and I was given a tour of the Large Hadron Collider. That's not relevant to the talk. I thought I'd just drop it in. Because I can. And the particles in that collider, it's a 27-kilometer ring, another not relevant thing. It's a 27-kilometer ring. The particles that they accelerate around that ring, 27 kilometers in circumference, those particles, the protons, whiz round 11,000 times a second. And then they go another beam in the other direction, and then they're collided. Isn't that fantastic? Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, you can forget all that. For heaven's sake, don't remember that fact from the talk. Remember kindness. Yeah, that's the key message. But what I'm trying to say is that the universe is far more mysterious, matter is far more mysterious than we think, life is far more mysterious. The Buddhist position that actually everything is to some degree conscious, that consciousness is the nature of things, that consciousness is primary, at least deserves serious exploration. Yeah? Because we don't have much better. Okay, moving on. The third fundamental assumption that is an obstacle to wisdom is that there's a really existing independent world out there and a really existing independent me in here. Somewhere in here there's a me, and somewhere out there there's an objective world. Now that doesn't really hold water when you start thinking about it. It doesn't take that much thought to sort of undermine that common sense view. Because after all, if you start to say, well, what is it that's so objective and solid out there? Well, anything that you can look at and point to starts to, under a little bit of analysis, fall apart. So, you know, look at a flower on the shrine. You see something that you think is out there. But what you're seeing is an image that's an image of light playing on the retina of your eyes, translated into, I don't know, electronic signals in the brain. You're having a visual moment of perception, yeah? And you see a white or a yellow flower. And we know that white or yellow are perceptual images. There's nothing yellow in reality. Yellow is how we perceive a particular wavelength of light. If we had different eyes, if you were colorblind, it would be a different image, a different perception. Yeah? The same goes for touch. Touch, it feels so solid when we touch something. But that's only, a scientist would know that that's only because the electrons on your hand repel the electrons on the solid, so-called solid object. Actually, your hand and the so-called solid object are mostly empty space. There's nothing solid there. The only thing that's stopping you from falling into the ground is electromagnetic repulsion. Yeah? So we kind of know that everything revealed to our senses, touch, taste, sound, smell, sight, is perceptual. It's happening in perception, but it can't really be like that independent of us perceiving it. Yeah? Independent of perception, we don't have a clue what's out there. When we're not looking, we don't have a clue what's out there. Yeah? You close your eyes, you turn the lights off, you don't know what's there at all. In fact, to the point where Buddhism doesn't even definitely say that there is something objectively out there. And what's more, some interpretations of modern physics say the same thing. Yeah? Niels Bohr was famously holding this view that objective reality was a construct. There isn't an objective reality. We create our world. We create our world with our imagination, with our mind, with our sense apparatus. It's a creation. Yeah. So that's outrageous. Yeah. Never mind this pale blue dot. Because, I mean, when you can still have this pale blue dot and have this vastness of perspective and still think that you live in a dead universe. Yeah. That's what most physicists do. So they can have this infinite perspective about, you know, I don't know, loads of dimensions and infinite space and eternities of time and still think, oh, it's a dead universe. But then you look a bit more closely, and at least Buddhism would say it's not a dead universe. That is an incredible statement. What if everything is of the nature of life? That's outrageous. Yeah? Think of that. You can barely conceive what that means. But even that is not enough, because you could still think, oh yes, it's a living universe, and maybe some ecologists think like this, or some systems theorists think like this. They think, oh yes, it's a living universe, but they still think it's out there, and there's a real me in here watching it. Yeah. But then Buddhism says, hang on, out there and in here are illusory. There isn't necessarily a real out there with a real objective anything. And what's more, this sense of me in here as an independent agent, that's illusory too. Yeah? Can you start to see how Buddhism is undermining all conceptual frameworks? Any way of conceiving anything is starting to be undermined. What Buddhism would say is that our very notions of space and time and form, matter, they're not objective. It's not like there's space and time and then we're plonked in it with a body. It's more the other way round. There is mind, whatever that is, and we don't know. There is mind, and space and time and form arise within it. It's the other way round. It's like the body arises in mind, not mind arising in the body. That's weird. Yeah? So I say this, but I don't know what I'm talking about. All I'm trying to do... So in a way, don't worry if you don't know what I'm talking about either. It's better that we start to be baffled. We should be baffled. We should be baffled by life. In a certain sense, if we were all receptive, we wouldn't need all these clever views that I'm just trying to undermine. We'd be baffled by the wonder of the stars. We'd just go out into the night sky and be full of wonder. It's just that in our stupid, clever postmodern age, we've lost this capacity to wonder. Yeah? So I'm trying to undermine all those assumptions where you think, I think, we know what's going on. We haven't a clue. We haven't a clue. So forget the honey on the porridge and look a little bit more deeply at what's going on. So then what is going on? So Buddhism won't give you easy answers. The reason it won't give you easy answers is because all our conceptual frameworks have fallen away, including the framework of subject and object. If a subject and object framework falls away, if space and time falls away, then language falls away. There is no language for this. Apart from, perhaps, the languages of images, the language of images, of poetry, of the imagination, which can point, yeah, which can point. If you're prepared to let an image speak to you, you might see something with the eye of imagination that is closer to reality than any of your ideas. So in the puja, that's what we're doing. We're trying to open this eye of imagination that sees with wonder. Unfortunately, our narrow, literal, secular brains think, oh, religious mumbo-jumbo, I must have an early night. What a stupid thing to do when we could potentially see more clearly for once in our life. So I'd really urge you, well, like Vidyadhara was urging you, to make the most of the precious, precious opportunity that we've created together. Broaden our minds. Just try it. Yeah? Just try it. So yes, Buddhism uses images, and I want to use a particular image that's associated with the Buddha Virochana. It's from a sutra, a late Buddhist sutra, a Mahayana sutra called the Gandavyuha Sutra, which itself is part of a much larger sutra called the Avatamsaka Sutra. And this sutra has profoundly influenced the Zen Buddhist tradition and Chinese Buddhism, Huayan. A whole tradition of Buddhism has been particularly founded around this sutra. And this sutra uses images to talk about the nature of reality. And one image, in the Gandavyuha Sutra, there's a sort of pilgrimage. There's a pilgrim, a young man called Sudana, who wants to understand the nature of reality, and he goes from teacher to teacher to teacher, starting off with the Buddha, the Bodhisattva Manjushri or Manjushri. And each of them give him a little bit of a teaching and then send him on his way to the next teacher. And I think there's 53 encounters that he has, Sudana has, before his final teaching, where the Buddha Maitreya, who is the Buddha of the future, so already we've stepped outside of ordinary time, the Buddha of the future leads him to a tower. And this tower is Virochana's tower, the Buddha Virochana, his tower. And Sudana approaches this tower, and it's beautiful. And it's adorned with scintillating garlands of jewels and flowers and flags, prayer flags fluttering, and lights, lamps burning. So it's this tower of light and precious jewels and beautiful flowers. It's a sort of living symbol of the universe. And Sudana enters. He enters this tower, this round tower. And then inside, what he finds, instead of just finding that he's encompassed by the walls surrounding him of the tower, what he finds is that he's in a vast space. A vast space. So it's like a TARDIS, this tower. Inside, it's incredibly vast. And inside the tower, there are hundreds of thousands of other towers, just like the one he's entered. Just like the one he's entered. Each one beautifully garlanded, beautifully adorned. And of course, that is how reality is. It's this complete interpenetration of all things. And some Buddhists, including in our order, are sort of sceptical about this vision. And they say, oh yes, well, it's sort of fanciful, it's later Buddhism, it's poetic, but don't take it too seriously. It's not really like that. The Buddha didn't teach about Virochana's towers. It's not really like that. And I once asked Sangharakshita, I said, well, I was intrigued by this teaching of the mutual interpenetration of all phenomena, everything containing everything else, the world in a grain of sand, as Blake saw it. I just sort of said, I asked Bhante, I just said, how does one experience that? What should I do to experience, you know, that I can sometimes glimpse the truth of impermanence, but this truth of everything containing everything else, every particle containing the whole cosmos, how does one even begin to realize that? What do you do? And I didn't frame it as articulately as that. I was sort of stumblingly, fumblingly as I was giving him my tea, just, you know, trying to make myself understood. And he just looked at me, and he chooses his words really carefully. Bhante is incredibly precise about his language, his words, and how he uses them. There's not a spare word. Every word is worth listening to. He looked at me, and he didn't answer my question. He didn't tell me what I should do. He just said, yes, all things contain all things. Huh? And that was it. And I was like, wow, it's true. And that reflection, that image is still something that fuels my meditation practice. I want to experience something of this. And sometimes I get something of a glimpse of it. What happens is that when we still our minds, when we let go of self-clinging, of me and mine, consciousness expands, just like the inside of that tower. Yeah? It expands. Now, it doesn't expand in three-dimensional space, just as the outside of the tower is in three-dimensional space and remains finite. Inside, it's infinite. And you can experience that, I can experience that in our minds. Inside, it's not that we're locked into this little few centimetres of the head. Inside, it's infinite, but not in three-dimensional Newtonian space, in an inner space. Yeah? In this inner space, there are no boundaries. There are no limits to the nature of mind. And it's as if, in that inner space, everything is contained. And what if everything has that inner dimension? Not just human beings, but what if even the dust particles have an inner dimension? What if each grain of sand has an inner dimension where if you could be that grain of sand, inside it would be infinite? If everything has that inner infinite dimension, then everything in that inner dimension contains everything. And this outer way of perceiving, where everything is boundaried and separate and fixed, what if that is the illusory reality? What if this inner way of perceiving is more fundamental, more true? Wouldn't that be amazing? There's an image from physics that I also find helpful, and it's the image of a hologram. The analogy of a hologram. It's an analogy. In a hologram, you have a plate, a holographic plate, and when you shine a laser through the plate, you get this three-dimensional image Yeah, as you do in, I don't know, Star Wars or whatever, you get this three-dimensional image that you can walk around. So say it's an image of a tree on this holographic plate. You shine this laser light through, and yes, you get this magnificent three-dimensional tree. When you have a photograph is just a two-dimensional image, isn't it? And if you cut the photograph in half, you get half a tree. But if you cut the holographic plate in half and then shine the light through half the plate, you still get the whole tree. And if you cut it in half again, you still get the whole tree. And half again, you get the whole tree. At a lower resolution, but the whole image is encoded in every part of that holographic plate. Everything contains the whole. Every part contains the whole. That's an analogy. That's an analogy. But modern physics takes this holographic principle quite seriously. And some modern theories of what's going on says that maybe the universe is more akin to a hologram. Maybe this is what is going on. And somehow this notion that we're all separate is just the illusory order. There's a deeper underlying order, a patterning that's much deeper, where everything contains everything else. Everything is completely interfused with everything else. So you've got Verochena's tower. Now that's just an image of what might be going on. But I don't think even that's enough, because it all can feel too abstract, can't it? It can start to seem still too abstract. What Buddhism does is it says, Verochena's tower, magnificent though it is as an image, isn't enough. You need Verochena. You need Verochena. You need this reality, this truth personified. You need it appearing to you as a human form. And why? Because human forms move us in a way that towers don't. Yeah? So human forms move us. A beautiful human form moves us. I don't have to explain that. Yeah? And also, human forms imply mind. They imply life. They imply consciousness in a way that a tower doesn't to us. But what I'm trying to get at is that everything is of the nature of mind, is conscious, is vibrating with life. The best way that we have of depicting that is to personify it. And of course, religions all over have personified this reality, or whatever they conceive of as reality, and they've called it God. Unfortunately, the language of God is still within this framework of a subject and an object. It's just that God becomes the ultimate object, the big daddy out there. Yeah? He's the ultimate object that you can fear or love or whatever you do, but it's not this mutual interpenetration of all phenomenon. Whereas Buddhism personifies reality, but then doesn't take that personification literally. It says it's as if. It's as if there's this beautiful, scintillating, white form that's dazzling, like the sun is dazzling, that's radiant, that's shining, that's bedecked with jewels, that is the embodiment of wisdom, and that gazes on you with infinite kindness. That is closer to how things are than any of our dead universe and its theories. The reason also that it's so important that we don't forget the personified images is because all of this abstract talk could make it sound that the individual doesn't matter. Yeah? In this vastness, what does my life matter? What does your life matter? It's fleeting, fragmentary. Does it matter at all? And of course it does, because what Buddhism says is that everything matters. Everything is sacred. There is nothing that isn't holy. Everything matters. Because everything is of the nature of life. Everything is pulsating with the energy of love. That is how things are, and that's what this personified image is representing. That's why the Buddhas are a direct image of reality. That's what who Virochana is. So the personal matters, but not in the egocentric me and mine, have I got honey on my porridge way. It matters in a far, far more profound way. So I'm going to start drawing to a close by just talking about, well, me more personally, and saying that for me, in a certain sense, I feel further away from this vision that I've talked about of enlightenment than ever. I think that the more I sort of touch of Buddhism, the more far away the goal seems to be, and the more aware I am of my petty, self-centered concerns. And I feel sort of, after 21 years of practice, in some ways I feel as far away as I ever did. And yet I can truly say that it is the most meaningful, magnificent way of living a life that I can ever, ever imagine. I feel profoundly grateful for having stumbled upon the Dharma, well, on this retreat 20 years ago. It is the most meaningful thing in the world to try and broaden our perspective and learn to love. It is the only thing in the world. That is what life is. Of course we fail. I fail all the time. And I don't mind. I don't mind anymore. I do really feel that if I were to die now, and I'm older than my father when he died, but if I were to die now, I would die content. I hope that will be true when it comes to die, but that's how I feel now, that I would die knowing that I'd tried to live a life of meaning and value. And I know, and I knew from my first retreat, that if I ignored what I was experiencing, I would die unfulfilled and I would die bitter. I would have died after that first retreat more disappointed in life than if I'd never gone on that retreat. Because on that retreat, I glimpsed something of the truth of the Dharma. If I had turned my back on that truth, something in me would have never rested. It would have known that I was turning my back on the most precious, profound meaning that there is in life, and I turned my back on it because I was concerned about the house, the car, the relationship, the honey in my porridge. Yeah, and I personally am so, so grateful that I've not had to do that. I would really urge each of us to really think about, what will it be like when we come to die? What will you regret? What will you regret? And try to make amends now. And I think what will matter is how broad our perspective has been and how much kindness we've managed to show in the world. That's what will matter. That's what will matter. So what are we going to do? For heaven's sake, if you've just had something of a glimpse of this, don't forget it. If you haven't, fair enough. Go home, live your life. I really wish you well. But if you have, then don't forget it. I want to just finish with a story from the last moments of the Buddha's life. Maitreya Bandhu touched on the last moments of the Buddha's life by giving the last words of the Buddha. Appamadena sampadeta, with mindfulness strive on, or with the least amount of drunkenness strive on, as Maitreya Bandhu so eloquently put it. I'm not going to refer to the last words of the Buddha. I want to refer to some words of a friend of his. As the Buddha lay dying, as the Buddha was in his final hours, maybe moments, his companion, friend, attendant, lifetime friend and cousin, and an attendant for 25 years, Ananda, his perhaps closest friend, you could say, who wasn't enlightened. At the time of the Buddha's parinirvana, Ananda still hadn't reached enlightenment. And he is weeping. He's weeping. And he doesn't want to disturb the Buddha. The Buddha is completely serene. Completely serene and just concerned about his disciples. And lying on the ground on a sort of seat made for him or on a couch made for him. Completely unconcerned. And Ananda has to take himself off because he's weeping. Probably weeping uncontrollably. The Buddha notices that Ananda isn't around and is concerned for him and sends another monk to say, friend, go and find Ananda. What's happened to Ananda? Make sure Ananda's sort of all right. That's how I like to imagine it. This concern for Ananda. And so the monk goes and sees Ananda, and Ananda is weeping and he says, alas, the Lord is about to pass away. The light of the world is about to pass away. I am still a learner, and my master, the teacher, the light of the world, is going out, and I am still a learner. And then he says, he who was so kind is leaving the world. He who was so kind. He doesn't talk about the Buddha's incredible enlightened vision. He doesn't talk about his wisdom. All he talks about, or that's what occurs to him when the Buddha's about to die, is he who was so kind. Bhante Sangharakshita says, half of Buddhism is in that remark. Half of Buddhism is in that remark. The other half I'll leave for you to work out. Thank you.